You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up in this week's Parish Council, how to know to jumper, a balloon riot in South Korea, Lady Gaga, stop and frisk in New York, Peruvian cocaine reviewed, and the pretend iPod.
Hello everybody and welcome once again to the Parish Council. This is the podcast from the Rocking Vicar and you're very welcome. I'm Magnus Shaw and he took me by surprise, I must say. It's Derrance Dackham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello, sir.
I hear that Scottish woman is back there at the front there.
Yeah, sounding in good voice again after her ailments. Yeah.
Oh, good to have her back. Now, recently, Magnus Shaw, you've helped the government solve the issue of fracking. And last week, of course, you sorted out fubbing. So this week, the Nation has contacted me, all of them, as we need your advice on fashion statements for gentlemen of advancing years. Not that you fit into that category.
Oh, I don't know.
But as a man of style, obviously you'll be able to help us here. The letters page of the Daily Telegraph has this week been absorbed with the subject of jumpers, and that's sweaters if you're listening in the United States. We have a lot of listeners in America. And Mr. Logan of Derry has highlighted the problem of what to do with a jumper or sweater when you take it off. And he says there comes an age when it's just not suitable to drape the garment over the shoulders. Yet one is also too old to tie the sleeves round your waist. So, Magnus, help us here. What is one to do with one's jumper if the sun comes out and you need to take it off? What are we to do with it?
Well, I have to say, I've absolutely no idea, simply because I don't wear jumpers. I don't have any knitwear at all.
Do you know, it's funny, my first note, I thought, I've got a little sort of bullet point of notes here. My first one is, I don't own one single jumper. Same as you.
Yeah, and I think the reason why is that we had to wear one at school.
Ah, oh, I'd forgotten about those.
And I think...
Grey V-neck jumper in my case.
Yeah, we could select each morning from blue or grey. That was our choice. That was a smidgen of freedom that we were allowed there to choose a jumper. And I think there's a little grain in my personality, in my subconscious, that says you don't need jumpers. You're grown up now, so I never buy jumpers.
Did you have, when you were at school, did you have a jumper? Did you have a little badge on it that said prefect or milk monitor? Did you get badges handed out for these things?
Yeah, well, we did have such things at school.
Were you one of the elite?
Well, no. Here's a funny thing. I don't know if I've mentioned on the podcast before, but I shall mention it now. I was actually expelled from my school.
Oh, good Lord, I don't think you have.
Right.
Well, you better tell us now. Well, you're starting, so you've got to finish.
It wasn't an instant thing. It was a sort of an accumulative thing.
You had to ask for other offences to be taken into account.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Well, the clue that I was going to be, shown the door came when, at the end of the fifth form, which is when I was given the old Spanish archer, everybody who went into the sixth form, as a sort of bonus for good service, for time served, I suppose, would either be a house prefect, which was the lowest rank, or a school prefect, which was the middle rank, or a headmaster's prefect, which was the top level.
Yeah.
And at the end of the summer term, all the fifth formers going into the sixth form the next term, would go to the notice board, because on there would be posted which you were going to become, whether you'd be a house prefect, a school prefect, or a headmaster's prefect. And up went the notice in the last week of the summer term, and everybody sort of dashed to the board to see what they were going to be, including myself. And I ran up and down the list several times, and I wasn't on it.
There was no Magnus Shaw, no matter where you looked.
No, and shortly thereafter... I was hauled in and ceremoniously dumped on my hiney.
Crikey. Yeah. Well, no wonder you've got a bit of an aversion to school-related clothing.
So I never got to wear a badge of any description.
I'm very sorry to hear.
The badge of shame, Terence.
the badge of shame as you scuttled off home to report to your parents.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
Oh, dear. No, I don't like jumpers either. I find them too clingy. And I have to say, a little claustrophobic. Especially jumpers, round neck jumpers, and V-neck jumpers. I may end up wearing a yellow V-neck jumper when I'm about 70 or 80.
Like a Ronnie Corbett style.
yes. And sort of, ill-fitting jacket and possibly a cravat. I haven't given up on the notion of a cravat.
That's a nice idea,
No, I jumpers, sweaters, they're too claustrophobic. I have the same notion with scarves as well. I only wear a scarf if it's loose-fitting. I don't like something tight around my neck.
I certainly wear a scarf in the depths of winter, but and I think there's still a part of me that craves being a punk rocker, and jumpers weren't very punk rock. I think in my head, I'm still a 15-year-old punk rocker, and you would never put a jumper on to go to watch the Angelic Upstarts, would you? So,
do you remember there was a sort of fashion for a while, a very fluffy, sort of neon type.
Now
jumpers.
I had a couple of those. Yes. I had a blue stripy one. And a black one. I think they were called Funky Monkeys or something. I seem to remember. Right. Or that was the brand, the manufacturer that made them. And I did have a couple of those because John Lydon wore one, didn't he? A massive mohair one.
Oh, that's it. They were mohairish. Yes, that's
so
it.
So I guess there was a certain punk rock jumper, but no, the more I certainly wouldn't be walking around in a giant stripy fluffy jumper now. But
That's a shame.
But the more sober jumper seemed a bit square, and I still think they are somehow.
I still feel that too. I think there's a number of items of clothing that I have a bit of a fixation on that, they just don't cross my path. I'm not a fan of ties, really. I've never owned a pair of sandals in my life. I can't abide sandals. And I think there's also a time, there comes an age, the age of man, when trainers are no longer suitable.
I
see a lot of older chaps wearing jeans and trainers. No. I mean, no man should ever wear shorts apart from on the beach or in a sporting activity.
I must disagree there.
You go out in shorts.
Yeah, as soon as the weather's hot. Bingo, it's got to be shorts.
Lord, people of the Midlands, beware. also forbidden by law, sleeveless vests. We've talked about them before. They should be.
Yes, I mean, I do own a couple of those.
Good grief, I'm getting a completely different picture of you. This is not the man I thought I knew.
Like a singlet thing.
Yes, like a singlet thing.
I must have bought them 10 or so years ago for holidays in foreign parts, and I have to say I don't really wear them anymore.
I was a bit horrified there for a moment. If you're not wearing them, that's fine. I've got one last clothing no-no, and that I think any man aged over 20 should only ever wear black socks on his feet. No coloured socks.
No, I don't have any coloured socks. They're black, and I've got a couple of dark grey pairs as well, but no, and certainly no comedy socks with the...
Oh, no. Especially sort of Christmas socks with reindeer or Santa Claus.
Yeah, or Family Guy socks.
I think the nation can be grateful. You've solved the problem about what to do with your jumper or sweater. Don't wear one.
Don't wear one, no, exactly. I mean, if it does get too hot for whatever you're wearing. I mean, I have some hooded tops, like a la...
Well, with your school record, that doesn't surprise me, frankly.
Yes, exactly. As if it's too hot for them, just take them off and put them somewhere. Why do you have to, why do you have to do anything with them other than, put them somewhere?
Well, yes, the bin, some may say, but I wouldn't be.
Those hooded tops are quite handy if you know you're going to be hot during the day and it's going to cool down at night. On a holiday or at a festival or whatever, and you can just pop a hooded top on. That's quite handy,
I'm afraid I've got a rule for them, though. They're only acceptable if they're the type that zip up all the way from the bottom of the sweatshirt to the top. Not those ones that have got no zip at all. Yeah. So, again, it's the claustrophobia thing.
Yeah, no, mine are zip through, yeah.
We'll accept those. So your advice, most welcome. Now, I'm not sure if we've ever featured news from South Korea before. So this could be a first. Mm. This week, 20 people were injured, 7 seriously, when a promotional stunt in Seoul for a new smartphone went wrong. The idea was that 100 helium-filled balloons were released. Each had a voucher for one of the new LG smartphones attached. And the balloons were released. And if you found a voucher, you could claim a phone. So far, so good. But unfortunately, some people got rather carried away, literally in some cases. The event was launched in a park in Seoul, and people came armed with air guns to shoot down the balloons, causing a massive surge when the balloons came down as people scrambled for these vouchers. Will this damage the brand, Magnishaw, or is it the old adage of any publicity is good publicity?
Yeah, I mean, that adage kind of holds true, although I think we can all think of brands where that hasn't. I mean, I know my daughter was telling me last night that a fella from Beko has been round to her flat to replace a part in her Beko fridge, which was in danger of catching fire in the night.
Oh.
And I don't think that kind of publicity helps a brand in the slightest. So it's not completely true. But in this instance, yes, of course, because what it says to us, the consumer, is that these phones are so dang hot that people will wrestle each other anything to the ground.
People brought knives attached to sticks.
Exactly.
To try and pierce
that's
balloons.
What you want. The bad version of it is we released the balloons and nobody did a damn thing and they floated off. That would be the bad publicity. The fact that people were laying into each other, setting about each other, and bringing implements to bring the balloons down is great. That's what you want. So look at the fuss about our product. So there's no problem on the phone company's behalf there. I'm not surprised this was in South Korea because they're nuts about their technology in South Korea and always decades ahead of us in their technology. I mean, for instance, where we've spoken about this is that they have like umbrella Wi-Fi in South Korea, so that the whole country is covered by one Wi-Fi system, which you have to pay for, but wherever you are, whatever you're doing, there's Wi-Fi coverage.
I didn't know you had to pay for it. My dream is that it should be provided free.
Well, that would be great. I don't know what you have to pay for it, but it's there free or near free public Wi-Fi, and more to the point, available everywhere. So
well, exactly. If it was near free, if there was a nominal charge, I'd be okay with that.
And they've had that for ages in South Korea, so they do love their technology. So I'm not at all surprised to find that they turned up en masse. My concern would be in this country, I think, that they'd turn up with knives on sticks and pellet guns to service each other rather than to bring to bring the balloons down. So I'm glad it was just aimed at the balloons. But no, in terms of advertising, the phone company have got no worries there. That's exactly the kind of reaction you want.
Yeah, it's funny though that you say, and quite rightly, the South Koreans love their technology and that they're, right up to date, because also it was reported that one person carried what they described as a pointed staff, which is like terribly medieval, isn't it?
It is.
It's a sort of Robin Hood type thing, I would have thought a bow and arrow, actually, speaking of Robin Hood, might have been quite useful in
that would be better. I mean, helium balloons, they go right miles up in the air, don't they? You're going to have one hell of a pointed staff to get one of those.
Yeah, a 200-foot long pointed staff, waving it around amongst the crowd.
Yeah, exactly. But I do wonder what happened once these balloons came down, because there would have been some kind of mad scramble. But
I believe so. That's how the 100 people got hurt. By that very scramble. I think 7 of them were taken to hospital. Twenty people, 100 balloons. 20 people were injured and 7 seriously. So there was a bit of a to do.
Yeah, I suppose that does have some sort of negative reflection on the advertising campaign. But that'll soon be forgotten, and everybody will say, "Oh, that's that phone that everybody went nuts for." So
they took their pointed stick. to retrieve.
Not that I'm dismissing the people who are seriously hurt, but I'm just saying in terms of the marketing guys, I don't think they'll be fretting overly on that one.
Well, on the similar tone, really, of marketing, of course, none of us can sleep at night at the moment due to the raw excitement of the anticipation of a new Lady Gaga single was due to be officially released on August 19th. Now, as usual these days, the single was leaked all over the internet ahead of the release date. But what is unusual with the Lady Gaga leak, if I can call it that, is that the artist herself has asked her fans to report any site that is hosting or linking to the new single called Applause, by the way. So, Magna Shaw, are you one of Lady Gaga's little monsters dobbing in sites for Applause leakage?
Oh, no, certainly not. I do like the Gaga, you know. I particularly like that first album. The names I'm trying to drag up now. It's the Fame Monster. Was it called or something like
that? You're asking the wrong man here. Okay. I'm not wise to the Gaga.
I quite like that. But again, you know, is this not just a bit of PR? I mean, does it really matter? I think it matters a lot more to the artist, the management and the label than it actually does in the real world that music gets leaked. I mean, if it's being leaked, then one would assume that is because people are hungry for it, which should be good news for everyone. I know it's different if it's been leaked and is available to be pirated, but then it's the piracy aspect that should be troubling the managers. But the fact that it's come out before its release dates don't really mean anything anymore, do they?
No, not at all.
But for this very reason, I mean, there used to be release dates because the only way you could hear music would be on vinyl, tape, and latterly CD. So it was the date when that. For, you know, when that media was available and you could hear it for the first time. Well, you know, music exists on files and in clouds now, so it doesn't really matter when it becomes available. So I don't see what's concerning everybody quite so much, really.
Well, I think this has got nothing to do with piracy, but is in effect Lady Gaga, or more likely, as I think you alluded to, her management, I think they're using her fans to undertake work on her behalf. And of course, I mean, I checked this morning, nearly 40 million Twitter followers she has, 39,700,000 something. Yes. And that's a sizable army, isn't it, at your disposal. And so I rather suspect that those people telling Universal Records, oh, there's a link here, or this site's hosting it. I don't think they're all anti-piracy. They probably downloaded it themselves, but they're just saying, oh, you know, they're trying to sort of be on the right side of their heroine, Lady Gaga.
Yes, exactly. So, and when Universal or Gaga PLC are in receipt of all this data, then what?
this of course is the other point, isn't it? This is a well-trodden path of enlightenment that they still haven't grasped, that nobody can uninvent the internet. And even Lady Gaga couldn't stop this leak, so nobody else has any chance, have they? I mean, it's quite a telling little note for all artists for the rest of the time that the internet exists. If Lady Gaga, with 40 million Twitter users at her disposal, can't stop a single being leaked, you know, you've got no chance. And I think artists really have to accept this and find other revenue streams, because if they provided value and unique items and opportunity for fans, and I was thinking about, imagine Lady Gaga now, that, you know, this is leaked, she's, her management probably thinking, oh my God, we're losing a million sales, you know, a day because it's freely available on Pirate Bay or whatever. If, though, that they had some sort of offer that if you bought the official download or CD, that 100 people would get a chance to meet Lady Gaga and maybe have a photo opportunity at one of her gigs, you know, me to get a photo, get, you know, some sort of unique prize that money couldn't buy, then people, even though they had downloaded the pirate version, would perhaps the fans, those 40 million Twitter fans, might still, you know, go and buy the official version because they're going to get something unique with it. But I think if artists just pump out a CD or say, here's a download, you know, there you go, and give me a, you know, 79 pence for it, it's those days have gone. The world has moved on.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And the record industry's reluctance to embrace the technology that allows piracy is what has caused the popularity of piracy. I think that's the bottom line. But leaking is a slightly different thing, and the material had to come from somewhere, didn't it? Somebody's had those songs away, so it's really just a matter of security. But the cynical side of me says, well, look, let me put it this way. If I was, God forbid, releasing a single this week, or next week, actually, that sounds really nice, what I'd do this week is leak it.
Yeah,
I would leak it onto the internet. And then I'd make a big fuss about how upset I was that it had been leaked onto the internet, therefore guaranteeing me the column inches and the pre-official release buzz and fuss about the music, and then officially release it next week and reap the increased sales from the publicity about the leak. I'm not saying for one minute a little Miss Gaga has been involved in that, but it would cross my mind if it was me releasing music that might not be a bad idea to attract attention.
If I was a 13-year-old teenage girl, which is sort of a massive leap of imagination we need here, but if we were to assume that. Now, if you know, a 13-year-old in their bedroom with limited income, let's say, you know, relying on pocket money, I don't know what happens these days, and I had the choice of going to X dodgy site and getting a perfectly playable download of my, you know, idol One Direction, Lady Gaga, you know, whoever, it doesn't matter, or paying 79 pence for it on iTunes, or perhaps even more coherently, something, you know, an album or something, and something worth, you know, whatever they go for on iTunes now, $4.99, $7.99, whatever, or just with one click having the whole album illegally. I think the overwhelming majority, knowing that the likelihood of them being caught is minimal, will go for that illegal download.
Yeah, of course they will. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. But I think there's a distinction, isn't there, between a leak and the music being available for illegal download? Because of course, even if the track hadn't been leaked, if it was absolutely, you know, incommunicado until release date, then as soon as it's released, it's available for illegal download, isn't it?
Well, exactly. I mean, there's another element to this, Magnus, is which it's becoming increasingly popular now that if somebody's releasing an album in particular, they'll say, oh, and we're going to have it available for you to listen to first, and we're going to stream it on, over here in the UK, on the Guardian website or the Telegraph website or something, stream. Again, seeming to ignore the fact that an eight-year-old has the rudimentary knowledge of how to capture a stream.
Yeah, exactly. No, you know, precisely. And I think I think they must be taking their technical advice from David Cameron's office.
Yes.
They don't really understand this sorcery with which they're playing. But I just think the notion of music being leaked before its release date is bunk. I think it's history. I don't think there is such a thing as a release date. As soon as the music has been completed and is available as a file, even inside a record company, then it's released because somebody somewhere will put it on a server. So again, like as you rightly say, the industry should embrace that and say, okay, you know, it's out there. Yeah. It's like getting everybody to report the sites on which the leak is available is bananas. Capitalize on the fact that people have started to listen to your new material.
Absolutely, and then give them something of value for them to want to, you know, go down the pay journey.
Yeah. The new Gaga single is out there somewhere. Can you find it? You know,
Good one.
Make a a virtue of the fact that, that some people have already got it. You know, give it an air of mystery. Don't say, you know, this. Please report it immediately. But it, apart from anything else, as Metallica found all those years ago, it makes you look like a dreadful party pooper if you start demanding that people are somehow brought to book for listening to your music. It does not give a good impression of you as an artist.
And as if to reinforce that, despite her rather desperate campaign, that the leaks won, and Lady Gaga was forced to bring the release of the single forward, and it was actually rush released on Monday of this week.
Well, yeah, so. But that's a lesson learned. You don't really need to give it a release date. I mean, you can say it will be available on iTunes and on Gaga's website from this date. But really, as I say, once it's encapsulated in some file format, you've got to assume that people have started to listen to it.
Yes, you
do. And that's no bad thing. That's no bad thing. So why would you be upset that people are listening to your new music?
Yeah, only if you're living in, 1977 or something.
Exactly,
A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned the sus law, suspected person, when we were discussing the Notting Hill riot of 1976. And this was a law that gave UK police the right to stop and search any person that they considered might be intending to commit an offence. It was hugely controversial, as we talked about it a few weeks ago. It was considered to be misused and targeted on racial makeup, apparently mostly towards black people, especially young black men. And this sus law was repealed in the UK in 1981. 32 years after that law was repealed in the UK, here in the summer of 2013, the city of New York finds itself now in a similar mess. New York police have been using a stop and frisk program under the same code of suspicion that someone has a criminal intent, and the same accusations now of racial profiling are being highlighted. So, Magnus Shaw, are you a supporter of stop and frisk, he says, knowing the answer?
No, absolutely not, because the same thing always happens is that people start to become profiled, not on the likelihood that they are involved in criminal activity, but due to their appearance, and more often than not, that is based on the colour of their skin or their racial heritage. It happens every time these kind of laws are introduced, and as you say, New York is now reflecting London in the late 70s, early 80s, because this is what always happens. I don't disrespect the police at all, but it's just human nature to get lazy about these things and to make massive assumptions that black people, particularly black people in groups walking about, they are likely to be committing crime, and we'll use this suspicion that now triggers a power to go and intervene in their activities. And that's not just a liberal paranoia. When you look at the statistics out of New York, it bears it out. So the population of New York City, the black population of New York City, is about 25%, so about a quarter of New York City is black. Then if you look at a table of people stopped and frisked in New York City under these laws, 53% of those stopped are black. So it's twice as much as random stopping and checking would suggest. And then if you go on, I don't want to get bogged down in statistics, but if you go on and look at the areas in which the most stop and frisk interventions have taken place, they are places, like Brooklyn, where there is a high black population. So it very, very quickly, whatever the intention of these kind of laws, it very, very quickly becomes a racial issue. And that breeds breeds discontent, that breeds resentment between a minority population and the police. And we know where that eventually leads to. So I wish people would learn the lesson. And it invites lazy policing. That's what happens. Mm. It, instead of investigating perpetrators, whatever the color of their skin, it invites police to pick people, you know, like a lucky dip, you know, just pick people out on a whim and hope that you catch them. And it's not even effective, really. It's not even an effective way to police a city.
No, those against Stop and Frisk in New York point out that, to support what you're saying, out of 4.4 million stops, the number of people who actually stopped for Stop and Frisk, 4.4 million between 2004 and 2012, only 12% resulted in any legal action all. But, On Monday, a Manhattan, this is on the other side, I'm going to say now, on Monday, a Manhattan federal judge ruled that a monitor for Stop and Frisk must be appointed because of the concerns that you're particularly highlighting there. But coming back on that, Mayor Bloomberg of New York City says that the program has led to a huge reduction in crime. And this is the stat that he's given out this week, that in 1990, I think that was that when Mayor Giuliani was there, I think so. 2,245 murders in New York City in 1990. Only, I say only, but relatively to that 2,245, 418 in 2012. So Mayor Bloomberg is saying, okay, you're telling me, you know, that we're getting this wrong, but look at the murder stats. You know, they've dropped, you know, by a massive margin.
Yes, but he's conflating two things without providing any proven link between them. They are just, as presented in that format, they are two arbitrary facts which he is creating some causation about. So we've no idea why the crime rate in New York has improved in that time period. It's absolutely impossible to say that is because of Stop and Frisk.
You're possibly right, but what he's asserting, just to sort of make clear the point I'm trying to say, that the point he's making is that because of, if you like, a criminal's fear of Stop and Frisk, in other words, being caught with a gun, a knife, or whatever, intent to cause a crime, that's actually stopping it before it starts.
Oh, I think that is quite a throw to get to that point. It really is, and I think people, as we all know, certainly in the West, that people intent on committing crime will pretty much go ahead regardless, and they would adjust their activity according to the likelihood of getting caught. They'll plan accordingly. I don't think people in New York or in any other city who are habitual gun carriers or habitual criminals in any other form will say, actually, I'm going to ditch all that and I'm going to get myself a decent job and and marry the girl next door because the NYPD may just pull me in the street. I think that's an awfully ambitious statement to make. I think the preventionary nature of it is highly dubious.
Well, we'll see how this unravels as the year goes on, because Mayor Bloomberg has served three terms now, and there'll be a new mayor in November. And of course, it could be our old friend Anthony Weiner, of course, who we talked about a couple of weeks ago.
And we know what he carries in his pocket.
Yeah, he wouldn't want to get Stop and Frisk.
Oh, he might do. It depends who was frisking him.
I suppose so. Do you know, he's very good. His campaign chief resigned a couple of weeks ago in light of the most recent controversies. So his campaign is stalling somewhat. Yes, Anthony Weiner actually striding the streets of New York, inviting policemen to to Stop and Frisk.
Me next. But the flip side of what the statement the mayor has said there, or the hidden context there, is that he is then therefore suggesting that a disproportionate amount of black people are criminals.
Yes.
If crime has been reduced by stopping and frisking a disproportionate amount of black people, then QED, he is saying that a disproportionate amount of crime is caused by black people. That's not a comfortable place to be.
It isn't, and you know, I think as you alluded to earlier, it's very possible that New York, all very often, way ahead of London in terms of lifestyle and so on. But in this, they may follow London's path from 30 years ago and end up repealing it and trying to find new ways.
I hope so.
Engaging.
I firmly believe the best way to intervene and prevent crime or detect it after it's been committed is always intelligence. It is always understanding the big picture, who's involved with what, who controls what, who is benefiting from what activity, and policing intelligently like that. Don't have the stats to back it up, but I feel in my bones that that is the most effective way to police any city.
When are you going to New York? Is it October?
October the 1st, yes.
October the 1st. So not only will you have to sample cronuts or the new cronut burger.
Yeah, somebody's introduced this soup kind of this week, yeah.
Indeed. But I would like you to bring back a Wiener for Mayor badge, if you can.
Oh, that might be easier than the cronut, actually.
Yeah, I think it might be.
I will attempt to do that, certainly. Yeah, yes. I'll definitely try and do that. If I can call a hold of one of these cronuts, I will definitely eat one, but it seems you have to get up at 4:30 in the morning, and
you do. You have to go and queue for
sleep
them,
in a tent outside the bakery. So
it's a bit like trying to get Wimbledon tennis tickets.
Absolutely.
I believe.
Yeah. I'm not sure whether my investigatory commitment stretches that far, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, over the last 5 years, since she was 21. Stacey Dooley has forged a career as a television presenter on BBC Three with a focus on accessible investigative journalism. And her sort of USP, unique selling point, is that she never speaks directly to the camera. She always talks to an unseen crew member slightly to the left or right of the lens. Stacey was working as a sales assistant in 2008 when she appeared in a well-received documentary about sweatshops in India, and the producers then offered her a series, Stacey Dooley Investigates, the latest of which, Cocaine Capital of the World, was shown on Monday. Now, at the time of watching the show on Monday, we were, of course, unaware that real life would jump aboard with the news that two young girls, one British, one Irish, had been arrested at Lima Airport in Peru, accused of attempting to smuggle cocaine. That wouldn't then have influenced your view, I imagine, on Stacey Dooley in Peru, Magna Shaw?
Yes, Stacey Dooley. I'm quite ambivalent about Stacey Dooley, and obviously these documentaries aren't aimed at me. You know, they're aimed at a younger audience, and I'm all for intelligent, I was going to say mind altering. unfortunate. Mind broadening documentaries.
Yes.
For younger people, because obviously it gives you a rounded view of the world, and that can only be a good thing. And I kind of get that Stacey Dooley is the sort of young female equivalent of Louis Theroux, in that she goes into these situations with a certain naivety.
Good analogy. Very good analogy, because that's what she does.
Yeah, better to unveil the subject matter. All that said, I don't think she quite has the smarts of Louis Theroux. And this sort of, I don't know what I'm doing here, sort of shtick gets a bit irksome. But she has improved. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago she did one on the economic crisis in Greece. Yeah. And she was so hopelessly out of touch with the subject matter that it did become slightly ridiculous.
I remember you tweeting about it.
Well, I think I wrote a piece about it, actually.
Oh,
yeah,
did you? Yes. With some fervour, I remember.
Well, yes, in that it was, an economic tragedy, unravelling in our very own continent, and was very well deserving of an in-depth documentary. She delivered the documentary. The in-depth bit was a little bit lacking. I think she's improved as she's clearly got up.
She's got more confident.
She has got more confident. And I do quite like the idea of you discovering things that none of us knew were going on alongside her. But what's lacking for me is then the backstory, the layers beneath that. And I don't think she really delivers that. She's much more interested, or the production team are much more interested in how is she going to get her wellies out of the mud than talking about, the poverty that gives rise to, all this was touched on, but the poverty that gives rise to the drug industry in South America and the political intrigue between the cartels and government. And I just wonder whether, with the BBC being as straitened as it is, that money wouldn't be better spent sending somebody who had a real grasp of the subject and a real insight into the subject matter to cover it. But I hesitate to, come down too hard on Stacey Dooley because, she didn't, within the context of the brief, she didn't do a terrible job here.
No. I don't know if you noticed, I felt there was an unfortunate choice of Ibiza chill soundtrack as a bed for a section highlighting the new breed of coca plants in the Amazon basin. But that was by the by. I just thought, was that deliberate or not? I thought it was an interesting section where a community is thriving and people are able to afford satellite dishes and so on due to the production of the coca plant, coca leaves. And it did lead to that moral dilemma, which it was sort of touched on. But as you say, it wasn't analysed in any great depth. It was that people can pull themselves out of poverty. And I noticed what Stacey said at this point. She said, who's right and who's wrong? Mm. It's hard. Mm. She said, it's hard.
She did grasp that nettle, though. It wasn't all about, look at these terrible drugs, what can we do to stop them? It was at one point, it was, the morally reprehensible notion of cocaine trafficking, but it did unravel to be, as you say, what do you expect these people to do? She did grasp that.
Well, I think it's an interesting point, as I say, a moral dilemma. What do you do in such a situation? Because we met this family that had been living below the poverty line, and, that's a pretty low line in the first place. And, they decided, essentially, they were living by the river. They decided to throw their morals in the river, cultivate cocaine, and they were, then able, like their neighbours, to buy fridge, a quad bike, a satellite dish, and whatever else they fancied in their little plot of land. Oh, they were able to afford a tin roof, which other people couldn't get. If you were in that situation, you may not consider the world picture of the the menace of drugs. You might think, well, I fancy a tin roof.
Absolutely, we would all do it. And of course, the people in the Amazon basin with their coca plantations don't actually have any concept of youths on housing estates in Hull buying wraps of powder and instead of going to college. They have no comprehension of that at all. And why would they? And what did strike me was that if she was investigating tobacco farming, nobody would be introducing the notion of criminality to it. Nobody would question that. And tobacco farming is a, in inverted commas, respectable industry. Yes. Farmers are encouraged and allowed to grow fields and fields and fields full of tobacco without any military flamethrowers going in and destroying it. And we could argue that tobacco is destroying more lives than coca plantations, so it's all a bit arbitrary as to what is immoral and illegal. Aside from Stacey Dooley's coverage of it, I mean, my take on it is, and I'm sure I've expressed this to you before, is look, the problem is the criminality. Now, I think if there's a market in the West for people who enjoy taking cocaine, give these people in South America the opportunity to enjoy good lifestyles by providing it, supplying that demand. Mm. Yeah,
it's a reasonable argument. I mean, many years ago, it would have seemed an outrageous thing to say, but there is an argument to say, well, they're going to... People who wish to use cocaine are going to source it from somewhere anyway. They'll probably buy it mixed in with a bit of cement, talcum powder, whereas if it was provided in a sense legally or decriminalized or checked or monitored or ensured it was clean and fresh, then, you know, you resolve half the problem at a push. But then, on the other hand, what government wants to be seen to be promoting?
That is the sticking point. Absolutely, that is the sticking point. That's why you can't make progress on these things. And, of course, the US and to an extent the EU will provide Peru with, you know, billions of dollars to destroy these crops and burn down people's plantations. To what effect? Almost no effect whatsoever, but it plays well with the electorate.
But also, as we've highlighted, sends then possibly hundreds of thousands, if not millions, into even further poverty.
I totally agree. Yes. And at a time where the whole world is looking for economic solutions, I would say you have a bit of an economic miracle sitting waiting to happen by multilaterally decriminalizing drugs. If people wish to use certain, and when we do have legal drugs. You know, I can go to Tesco today, I can buy alcohol, coffee, tea, and tobacco. So why not cocaine? It doesn't make any sense to me. It never really has. And Stacey Dooley, to her credit, did introduce that moral dilemma into it. It wasn't dumbed down telly. All I would say is that if you have the budget to make that kind of documentary, is it not a little indulgent to have Stacey Dooley, who isn't sort of, she's not daft, she's not stupid, she's not a bad presenter, but she's not an expert, put it like that.
No.
She's not an expert in either journalism or world affairs or narcotics. Is she the right person to front it? But I'd have to look at the audience figures, but if it's her that brings young people to these documentaries, then perhaps there's an argument for that.
Yeah, that's a fair point, and although a bit stagey at times, so it's arguable that it did provide an accessible guide to the journey of cocaine from its starting point in the Peruvian jungle to, as you say, the sink estates or housing estates in the United Kingdom.
I would like to see somebody like Richard Bacon front it, put it like that. And I think, well, as years go on, you know, Bacon moves further and further from that, having appeal to that demographic. But I think I think somebody like Richard Bacon still has a certain appeal to the BBC Three community, but also has the journalistic chops to really bring it alive. But that's not to say Stacey Dooley did a dreadful job, because she didn't.
This was Stacey Dooley Investigates the Cocaine Capital of the World. It was on BBC Three on Monday. It's on the BBC iPlayer. It's also, the full show is also available on YouTube.
Right.
And it was produced and directed by Stephen Grandison for Watershed Television for the BBC. And you know what, Magnus Shaw? That brings us to our closing topic, which is the pretend iPod.
No way.
And, yeah, it really is. And this is where you and I each choose a piece of music. We say why we like it. It becomes available on this very same pretend iPod on the Rocking Vicar website, which you can listen to, 140-something tracks now. We've been doing this so long. And also on Spotify under your auspices of Magnus Shaw. What have you got for us this week?
Well, I think I've mentioned on this very podcast how many people mistake Saturday Night Fever for a throwaway bubblegum disco flick, when, in fact, as long as you get to see the right cut of it, it's so much more than that. It brilliantly captures the hopes, fears and bleakness of teenage life for the Brooklyn working classes in the 1970s. However, that said, if you're also looking for some A1 Cuban heeled get up, get down, solid gold disco action, and let's be fair, who isn't? The soundtrack to the movie is absolutely crammed to the rim with them. Now, when the Bee Gees were asked to write a string of songs for the film, and of course for the record, they'd already split up once, were pretty much on the wane, and certainly weren't at the cutting edge of the burgeoning disco movement in the USA and to an extent in the UK at the time. But we're talking about the brothers Gibb here, and they always seem to have the musical fairy dust on tap. So although they weren't a disco act, they somehow managed to produce those gargantuan disco hits, Staying Alive, Night Fever, and my pick for this week, You Should Be Dancing. Well, if ever a song had an appropriate title, it was this one. A percussion part snaking around a robust four-to-the-floor kick drum, brass ripping into the beat and pirouetting around with a funk lick like a skater on coke, and that's all before the now legendary falsetto from Barry has even entered our ears. What you doing on your back? You should be dancing, he trills, and you know what? You really should, because this kind of masterpiece is really something else. If it doesn't send you to eBay frantically tapping in white flared suit, then you should check your pulse immediately. For the full effect, of course, listen to it with some of Travolta's astonishing moves on some screen or other. I'm sure YouTube, I should say, will provide the necessary. But for now, let's just call it my choice for the pretend iPod. It's the Bee Gees from the gargantuan-selling Saturday Night Fever original soundtrack, You Should Be Dancing.
As you say, what you're doing on your back, you should be dancing. Yeah. Yeah. I can't diss a song that rhymes good with blood, which they managed to do in the second verse. The only thing with Barry Gibb, the Bee Gees, right? Okay, I love the Bee Gees, and I love You Should Be Dancing. But, you know, once they discovered that Barry Gibb falsetto, they never let it go.
He's set for life, wasn't he?
Yeah. I know, and I hesitate to say this, but it ruins most of their records. And, you know, I've for fun, I've remixed one of them. It's on my SoundCloud stream, if you ever want to see it, but hear it rather. And I remixed one, Spirits Having Flown, to try and get rid of the falsetto. And my dream is that Barry Gibb contacts me and says, here you are, here's the master tapes, and I can go back with their greatest hits and remix them without the falsetto, because they just overdid it over the years.
Yeah, I guess they did, but then it became their trademark, and then you get the thing is that the huge Bee Gees fans, you buy the new Bee Gees album, of course, something that will never happen now, and it's all done in Barry's natural register, and they go bananas.
I suppose so,
isn't the Bee Gees. I think that the hardcore Bee Gees fans, that's what they wanted. They want Barry's falsetto. But I do know what you mean. Interestingly enough, the songs that you see Travolta dancing to, and all those other great dancers in the background in the movie, when you see them dancing to the Bee Gees stuff, You Should Be Dancing and all the rest of it, they're actually dancing to something else entirely. Because all the footage was shot by the time the Bee Gees were brought in to write songs. So,
yes, they were quite a late addition, weren't they?
Those dance sequences are very brilliantly edited, so it appears that they're dancing to You Should Be Dancing and Disco Inferno and such like, when actually they're dancing to other things.
I had no idea.
And the certainly the Bee Gees material was overdubbed on the dance sequences, but you would never know.
No, I certainly didn't. But, good choice. You Should Be Dancing. Yeah.
And I love Spirits Having Flown as well. Falsetto One Rock as well. I love that.
Yeah. Okay. I'll send you a link to the remix I did of it and see if you like it with the falsetto really reduced. Now, Magnus Shaw. Shirley Williams, former Labour MP and founder member of the Social Democratic Party. I've done it again, Magnus. It's not Shirley Williams.
I can hardly believe it.
Ugh. It's Stephen Wilson of the Porcupine Tree.
Oh, of course it is. Yes, of course.
Always get them mixed up.
Yeah. But he's also a grandee of liberal politics in the UK, isn't he?
Absolutely. And, you know, especially Shirley Williams, of course, played keyboards with Marillion for a number of years after losing a seat in Parliament. So it's an easy mistake to make. Yeah. The description... Sorry. The description polymath... immediately comes to mind when considering the career of Stephen Wilson, rivaling Todd Rundgren in his mastery of all aspects of making music, whether his extraordinary ability with every instrument he touches, his unique production style, or his splendid variety of collaborative projects. Stephen Wilson manages to be a positive member of several bands at one time, including Blackfield, No Man, Bass Communion, and also releases intriguing cover versions of ABBA and Cure records as a sort of side solo project. But today we're featuring what must be considered his principal project, Stephen Wilson, Porcupine Tree. Listening repeatedly to his parents' copies of Dark Side of the Moon and Donna Summer's Love to Love You Baby 12-inch mix led Stephen towards making his own music mixing experimentation with heavy pop influences. He started Porcupine Tree as a sort of homage to prog rock, but then found lots of people were actually drawn to this music. And it's actually led now to Porcupine Tree becoming a really serious band and releasing 10 studio albums, 5 live albums, 3 compilations and 9 singles. Stephen Wilson himself and Porcupine Tree fans consider the 2002 album In Absentia as their finest work, and I've selected the opening track, Blackest Eyes. It's a song that exemplifies that exact mix between beautiful melody and thunderous rock. The album was recorded at Avatar Studios, New York, during March and April 2002 and released September 2002. The album from which the track comes didn't chart in the UK or USA, but it has over 13 years now. It has sold 100,000 copies worldwide. So from the album In Absentia, the opening track, 4 minutes and 23 seconds, Porcupine Tree. Blackest Eyes.
Yeah, the Porcupine Tree and then the other bands you've mentioned there sort of show that prog rock never actually died, did it? It just sort of became new prog and just ignored any passing trends, didn't it? And it's always, there's always been a seam of sort of modern prog music that attracts a big following, doesn't it? But never sort of troubles the mainstream at all.
Well, I think Stephen Wilson himself is, you know, just absolutely wonderful at this. But if anybody's listening and thinking, well, yeah, I've not heard of the Porcupine Tree, listen to the end of the podcast because you'll hear a little snippet of You Should Be Dancing. Yeah, but also Blackest Eyes. And you'll hear, even in the snippet, a sort of one-minute snippet, a blend between that sort of prog rock theatre and the most exquisite melodies, and it just works so terribly well. As you say, it's not particularly mainstream, but Stephen himself is so now highly regarded. But you think that he started off this as a kind of a joke, really, Porcupine Tree, but he's now so well regarded that the likes of King Crimson, Jethro Tull, they've got him remixing their back catalogue right now. And even XTC, he's currently at this very moment again remixing, remastering part of XTC's back catalogue, their Nonesuch album he's working on at this very moment. So very highly regarded by musicians throughout.
Yeah, as I say, there's a prog, melodic prog sound that never leaves. So interviewed on the Parish Council, Steve Hackett, recently at the time.
Yes, you do.
His reinvented versions of Genesis songs was at number 8 in the album charts. So it just shows that there's a huge market for this, and Steve Wilson's seems to be at the forefront of that market. So that's a really good pick. That's a really interesting pick. That came out of the left field. I didn't see that one coming, but it's a great pick. Well, thank you for that. And unfortunately, as it's the second pick for the Pretend iPod, you know what that means. It means it's time to pack your little suitcase and trolley off back to your grandma's house, as it is me. because we must get away and do other things. But thank you very much for your contribution.
I haven't got a grandma.
No, I haven't either. But I was painting a picture.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Magnus Shaw.
Thank you very much. See you next week. And of course,
anyone listening, we thank you as well. See you in 7 days then. Bye-bye.
Production.
You see, no matter where I treat my guests, they always like my kitchen best.